just makes it harder. We'll go ahead and start our meeting as soon as everybody takes their seat. Oh, who you are, what area you're going to address. In closed session that we just completed, there was a student matter regarding the CASI exit exam regarding six students from San Luis Obispo High School. And there was a discussion regarding the negotiation relative to the labor unions groups with the district. And our public meeting, which is starting now, is asking the board if there's a consensus on the agenda items, on the order of agenda items, order of business. Hearing no disagreement, we'll have an approval of the minutes for two board meetings, which is, I think, anybody can make a motion on those two board meetings.
I'll move approval of the board meetings, and I don't have the dates in front of me. January 15th? No?
December 13th.
December 13th, thank you. And what's the other one, John?
December 18th.
And December 18th. I'll move approval of those.
All in favor?
Excuse me?
I'd like to...
As amended, no. First of all, or not amended as presented by Mrs. Holmes.
Well, what would
Something
you want
else.
To say?
First of all, who's your second? Thank you.
Okay.
We didn't do the discussion.
Yeah. Any discussion?
I have an additional correction besides the one that was delivered to you previously, because I sit here while I'm waiting and read through these things. I made a notation on the handout that I gave you on page 4 that Mrs. Rogers' absence was from the December 4th meeting, so you see that. On the subsequent page under item 14, it was Mr. Miller who explained that the bus drivers are in critical short supply, not Mr. Millar.
Okay. So I'll ask Chris if he wants to amend his motion to include those.
I'll accept that. Those as amendments.
So we have a motion so amended by Mr. Unger and seconded by Ms. Dickinson. Any further discussion regarding the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. Next, there's a presentation regarding the overview of cafeteria food regulations and district responses by Sue Thorson, please.
While Sue is coming up to the podium, I would remind the board that the overview of our food services department and what Sue's going to bring forth tonight was requested by board member Peter, who's retired, moved on. And so we bring it to you still as an item of interest since a number of board members expressed an interest in this topic.
Okay.
Sue,
thank you.
Ms. Thorson.
Okay. Over the last few years, we've become aware of the increasing incidence of childhood obesity. The National Center for Health Statistics has been studying this. Preschool children were overweight, and at the secondary level, it was about 17%. This has resulted in widespread concern, which has led to new federal and state laws. The first to be passed was the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act of 2004, which was passed by the federal government. The primary purpose of it was to renew and update the National School Lunch and the School Breakfast Program. However, one provision requires school districts to develop wellness policies, which the school district has done. These wellness policies are to be developed by multidisciplinary teams and are to address both nutrition and physical fitness. In this regard, it took a step away from traditional child nutrition legislation to look at the total community, not just community's involvement in the well-being of the students and not just isolating it to nutrition alone. More recently, the state of California has passed three laws which are affecting food and beverages sold on school campuses. Each of these laws amended the education code. We have Senate Bill 12, which addresses food. We have Senate Bill 965, which addresses beverages, and Assembly Bill 1503, which is related to trans fats. Senate Bill 12 just became effective this past July 1st. It affects all food sold to students on school campuses during the school days. It divides the food into one of three categories: It's either a complete meal, an a la carte entree, or a snack. Complete meals are defined as those that meet the requirements of the National School Lunch or School Breakfast Program and are considered to be nutritionally adequate and are desirable. When it gets to a la carte entrees, they're limited to 400 calories per serving and 4 grams of fat per 100 calories. We studied all of the entrees that we were serving, and the majority did not qualify to be sold on an a la carte basis. Therefore, starting this school year, we have focused on the complete meals and have very few entrees that are sold a la carte. An example is our hamburger. A hamburger has a 2.5-ounce beef patty on a whole wheat bun. It's very plain. It has 313 calories estimated, but it has 4.25 grams of fat per 100 calories, so it can't be sold a la carte. It's sold as part of a meal. At the middle schools, we've really pushed the complete meals. At the high schools, we still have vending carts that we made a turkey sandwich that qualifies, and we have a bean burrito that qualifies. 35% of the calories can be from fat, and a maximum of 10% of the calories from saturated fat. And when you look at the total weight of the product, it has a maximum of 35% weight from sugar. So a lot of traditional snack foods do not meet these standards. Candy, for one, is automatically out. Regular traditional fried potato chips are out. Most ice cream doesn't qualify, and very few baked goods do. So we are now using a cookie dough that is manufactured especially for schools. It's low in fat. We buy a low-fat brownie. We offer Italian ice and fudgesicles, which meet the ice cream requirement, and we've gone to a baked line of chips. We actually started phasing this in last school year to ease the transition this school year, so it's gone fairly smoothly overall. Senate Bill 12 does not restrict foods that are sold off-campus or foods that are sold at school-sponsored events directly after school, or anything that is sold more than a half an hour after the end of the school day. But all other foods sold on school campuses are regulated. The next one is the beverages. We are allowed to sell water. Milk, we're restricted to non-fat milk, 1% milk, or 2% milk. Or soy milk and rice milk are also permitted. Homogenized whole milk is not allowed. Fruit juice must have a minimum of 50% fruit juice in it with no added sweeteners, and artificial sweeteners considered an added sweetener. Vegetable juice is allowed. Electrolyte replacement beverages, that's Gatorade, Powerade type beverages, are allowed at the secondary schools but not at the elementary schools. We've been phasing this in over a couple years now. We had to be 50% in compliance at the senior high schools by this year, which were far more than that. And we've been in full compliance at the elementary schools and the middle schools for some time. We have until July of 2009 to achieve full compliance at the senior high schools. And we are now serving some fruit juice blends or drinks that we will have to discontinue eventually. That includes like cranberry juice cocktail, which has sugar added to it. And we do serve flavored teas, which do have sugar. And this bill, ties that funding, the reimbursement rate for the state funding, to limiting trans fat and certain fats that were that may be served. We have to certify compliance by June of 2008, so this is one that we're still working on. Schools are not allowed to fry food in any form. We are not doing that and haven't been for a couple years. Manufacturers may not fry food in prohibited oils. It doesn't exclude frying altogether, but the prohibited oils are typically the tropical oils and things that might contain trans fats. And then trans fat has to be limited to no more than 0.5 gram per serving. We're still trying to collect data from some of our manufacturers, and I think we're going to have to switch from margarine to butter. Some of the potato products may be a problem, but other than that, the crackers and everything else I've checked are fine. So that's it. Is there any questions on that?
Thank you, Ms. Thorson. Any questions by board members? Mark?
Yeah, just really quick. I want to thank you because this is an incredibly difficult and very rapid change that you've made, and I appreciate the efforts. It's my understanding that sometimes the food that the federal lunch program actually sends, the cheese and other products, do not meet their own specifications. Is that?
The cheese is okay when we use it as a complete meal because we do a nutritional analysis on our menus. So when you look at the overall, we're fine. The potato products are where they're having a problem and they're having to reformulate. We turned down all the potato products on this last offering as a caution, but that's the one thing that they may have a problem with.
Adrian?
I'm thinking about salads as a la carte items, and it seems to me that I read the materials where it's the dressing that has too much oil, but it seems like there's a lot of ways to have a lower fat dressings, like rice vinegar is really great on certain salads, and you could make a salad with lettuce and apples and oranges and raisins and just use orange juice as dressing, which makes a really delicious salad, which would have, no extra fat at all. I just think some creative salads would really be good for a la carte items. And I know at our school we do have a la carte salads, so I'm not sure how we get around that.
Okay.
Not that they're that exciting, but...
It is feasible for the students to use the salad bar as their national school lunch and take, provided they took enough from the salad bar. But the cashiers would really have to be trained to really watch it very closely that they did.
But it sounds like you could charge more if it were an a la carte salad. It's just something to think about.
Okay. We wouldn't let them be able to go out and take a ranch dressing and put it on, even though we buy low-fat ranch dressing, mm-hmm. because they really watch the condiments that the children take, mm-hmm. so the condiment would throw it off.
But if the dressings aren't separate but are packaged with the salad, that wouldn't really be an option. In our salads, the salad dressings are in there, and there's no dressing just sitting anywhere. If it were a low-fat dressing in the salad, packaged in there under the cellophane with the salad... It's just something to think about.
You'd have to limit it to vinegar and oil. I mean, vinegar dressing.
Something like that, which is pretty good on certain things. I have a couple other questions. Uh-huh. For people who are lactose intolerant, if you went to just butter, I mean, there's a yogurt butter that's really low in fat that is all right for people who can't have milk products. Just something to think about. Tastes delicious. And have we ever thought about, changing legislation with, like, olive oil is beneficial to diets, like allowing stir fries with olive oil. I mean, if they change the legislation to be... I don't know. I'm just thinking... there's probably some ways to tweak the bill that... I mean, there's certain things about it that... You know how laws are. They create certain problems and don't really meet the end at times. So probably there's lobbying to make sure to fine-tune it, perhaps.
Yeah, the salad issue is more complicated. I hadn't thought about the butter and the lactose. Mm-hmm. We use very little, so it doesn't isn't a huge issue, but we do use some right now.
Anyway.
It's been margarine in the past.
Catherine?
Thank you.
This includes breakfast meals, yes?
Yes.
I understand you have a really delicious cinnamon bun that you're able to offer. How does that work
in with this? It's a honey bun that's made for schools. It's made with whole wheat flour. And it does meet the requirements. It can be sold either a la carte or as part of the breakfast program. But it's manufactured by a company that's exclusively for schools.
Fabulous. It's very popular.
Okay.
Ms. Thorson, what's been the student reaction to the change in the food offering? And what's happened in terms of educating parents and guardians at home?
We started sending out announcements to all the parents last school year.
What was the educational effort with the high school families in terms of the change? You mentioned the transition.
We started last spring putting announcements in the school bulletins, and then we sent information home to the parents so that everybody was aware of why the changes were taking place. Summer school is when we had to start it because it started July 1st. And we did get some resistance initially in summer school. But recently, I haven't had any complaints.
Do you know if there have been more home lunches brought to the high schools because of this change? Can you tell the number of lunches if it's up, down, or stayed the same with the change?
I think at this point it's pretty much the same. Overall for the department, our income is up by about 2%. But, of course, you've got the offsetting labor increases and everything.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Thorson? Thank you very, very much for doing that.
Chris? I just want to acknowledge the hard work that you guys all do and just really the great job you do. There's a lot of behind the scenes that I don't know that people are aware of that's being conducted by really good, hardworking employees, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thorson. At the time of the meeting, I understand there was no correspondence to report. We'll move on to public comment. Is there anyone here tonight that wishes to address the board during the public comment section? Seeing none. We're going to reports by school staff and student representatives. Student representatives first. We could begin with Chelsea Parker from San Luis High School.
All right. So all of our sports are about, I think they're all top three in league. I read the paper every day to make sure that we won, we beat the other team. And our girls' soccer is on top out of all of our sports. They're undefeated, not just in league, but all around. And they got first at their Garces tournament in Bakersfield. So that was really exciting because I think they said there was about 64 teams. And wrestling is doing well. They had their first wrestling Mike O'Reilly wrestling match last weekend. And boys soccer is playing right now. Same with boys and girls basketball. They're all playing tonight. And then our principal advisory meeting is Thursday at 7 in the library, and everyone's welcome with that. And the SATs are on the 26th, and I know a lot of juniors are stressing about it because it's Friday, and we're going to hand out academic letters. There's 12 new recipients this trimester, and to get one, you have to have a 3.8 GPA for three trimesters or more. And then there's like 150 previous recipients that are also receiving it. And also all the sports will go and tell us how they're doing during their season. And the peer helping is a lot more alive this year, I guess. I've never heard of it happening before, but there's a lot of people involved and they're going to do a skit for us. And then lastly, our senior showcase auditions are February 12th and 13th. So everyone's trying to get their act together with that, and hopefully it'll be good this year. So.
Thank you very much, Chelsea. And Hannah Johnson from Pacific Beach High School.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Chelsea talked about sports, so I should talk about sports at our school. The boys really like to play football in the quad during break, and they have a lot of fun with that, but then the teachers like yelling at them, too, because they're going to break something. So, anyway, our teachers just finished their WASC accreditation, and they sent it off to the printer, so they're waiting for it to come back. They're really excited, and our representatives are coming in either late or early February. I don't remember. They're coming sometime in February. And our YSEMP, our Career Exploration Program, is just finishing up, and the kids had a lot of fun with it, and I think they all learned a lot. I think some of them actually got jobs through it, so which was really cool for them. And then our third marking period out of six is almost over, so everyone's excited that the year's halfway done. And so we have finals this week for that. And mock trial has been going on, and I'm in mock trial, and it's so fun. And actually, Walt Millar has been helping us a lot with it. He's really helpful. And we had a scrimmage today, actually, we ended about an hour and a half ago against Slo High. And personally, I think we did a lot better, but, you know, that's just me. They did really well, too, though. And we have this program, and I'm not sure what it's called, but somebody from the Cotton Ball in Morro Bay, he came and he does a lot of cool things with sewing machines and, like, embroidery on shirts and stuff. So some of our kids actually designed a shirt for our mock trial, and then they made it, so it's really cool. So I thought I'd show you guys that. It's pretty neat. Yeah, so we all got one, and we all wear them for, like, scrimmages and stuff.
Wednesday is the FFA banquet. I think it's one of our first this year, and it's at 6:30 if anyone's interested in coming. Saturday, we have quite a bit of events going on in our gym. We have varsity girls basketball. It's having a re-game of a game with Templeton. They weren't able to come down here during, I think it was a Friday night because of the rain. And so we're going to have a rematch at 2:30 if anyone wants to come watch that. The Winter Bird Festival takes place at our school this Saturday. It's 6 to 9 p.m. And also, our winter formal is this weekend from 8 to 11. Next week, we have CIT, which is one of the biggest wrestling tournaments here on the Central Coast. We have about 62 teams coming to our school. And we have a lot of teams on the waiting list, so it's going to be quite a big tournament this year. And that Saturday, we're going to have a pancake breakfast for the community. Anyone is invited, so if you guys want to come and get a pancake breakfast. It's just, all in all, it's been a good winter, and our sports are off to a really fast start. Our sports director has really kept us busy with our schedules. We have about, basketball has 3 games each week, so we stay really busy, and girls varsity basketball is undefeated, so it's exciting. Also, we have a new, very exciting thing that we just added to our school, our last sports assembly. It's called Blue Wave, and it's a spirit booster that we added for the students and also staff, and it's been a big hit. I brought one of the shirts to show it to everybody. They've been really popular. As you can see, the pirate is just right there in the front. It's really cool. The kids love it. Very creative. And we have MBHS right here on the back. And it was a really great design. And the kids really like it. And the staff really likes it, too. And if anyone's just in love with them, you guys can come buy them in the office. They're $5. So, and that's it for me. Thank you guys for having me here.
Don, thanks. And before you all go, questions? Catherine has a question.
Yeah, Don, the pancake breakfast, was that this Saturday or Saturday the 26th?
That's the following Saturday of the 26th.
Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine. And I want to tell you how much we appreciate you coming to share this. It's important because it's amazing all the activities that take place, and this is what school's all about. Thank you, and again, you don't need to stay for the rest of the meeting if you all have to get out into studies and what have you, but we really appreciate you coming. Thank you.
I would like to just run through a couple of them and frame the issue for you. First of all, the state of California has a $14.5 billion deficit. This is for the 08-09 fiscal year that they have coming up. They have a $3.3 billion deficit in this year alone. Given that the education budget is about 41-45% of the state budget itself, we make up a huge part of their expenditures, and we have a role in trying to assist in solving the problem. When the governor came out with his suggestions, he put it up in two different sections. One is a mid-year cut proposal, and one is a 08-09 proposal on how to address. Remember that any reduction in 2000, in a current year, 2007-2008, what they call mid-year cuts, reduces the minimum funding, not maximum, minimum funding for which schools are entitled to receive in the current year and in the future year. We currently enjoy an overallocation, if you will, of the minimum floor of $1.3 million that, if allowed to remain in place, would increase the floor in 08-09 by that same amount. The proposal that the governor gave us for the mid-year cuts is to reduce education's funding, which includes community colleges, by $400 million. What that would do is save $400 million this year and potentially save $400 million in the next year. Thus, it's an $800 million proposal. The $400 million on the K-12 level translates to $360 million, or about $30 per student in each district. In our district, it's a $60 per reduction. And what he's proposing to do with that $60 is to not pay us money he has promised to pay us, but hasn't yet sent us the cash, the check, he'll just withhold that. That would equate to about $30 per student, and then the district would be responsible for finding the other $30 per student. And those are general numbers, just to give you a sense of what he's asking us to do. So when mid-year cuts are discussed, they are very, very difficult to get your arms around, because there's not much left that hasn't been spent or obligated that is reversible. So mid-year cuts for us would be a very difficult prospect, as they would for any district. The second part of his proposal is to have a suspension of Prop 98. By the way, before I leave the current year, he would affect his changes by calling a fiscal crisis, invoking Proposition 58, and putting the legislature into session. And they have 45 days to solve the problem. If they don't solve it in 45 days, they are not allowed to go home, leave the room, until they come up with a solution. Essentially, they're in a lockdown until the fiscal crisis is solved. So they're highly motivated to do something in this current year. Moving to 08-09, his proposal is to suspend Proposition 98. He is calling for he's calling to apply the COLA to revenue limits, of which we're not a recipient, but we'll get to that in a minute. He applies the COLA, and then he takes back 7%. The COLA is expected to be 4.5%, thereabouts. Thus, the take-back of 6.9% or 7% is after the application of the COLA. That alone is in the ballpark of $300 per student. It's a little bit high, but it's about $300 per student. There's an additional call for a reduction in categorical programs and restricted funding programs, not the least of which is home-to-school transportation, special ed, K-3 class size reduction, instructional materials, all of which are programs that are funded by the state, but not 100%, and are programs that encroach on our general fund budget. So in effect, we are mandated to provide special education. We're mandated to provide other aspects. We do have choices on K-3 class size reduction. We have choices on home-to-school transportation. We have choices on several things. Yet the aspect of increasing an encroachment on an existing program puts a big hole in our budget. It would obviously affect something else.
Marilyn?
Excuse me, Mr. Miller. Just by way of giving us a little...
20 to 1, we have a current encroachment of $825,000. I don't have the number in front of me of how much we received from the state, but it's in the $2.3 million range, I think. So it's a $3.1, $3.2 million program, of which we pay $825,000. So, and that's representative of our special ed encroachment, $2.6 million. And we have a maintenance of effort requirement to continue to offer that. So there would be no option about some of these things.
Thank you.
Mr. President?
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the disturbing pieces of this is that the dollar amount, if the governor's proposal were to be adopted for 08-09, the dollar amount is in excess of $3 million for San Luis Coastal, applied to all of our programs and as if we were a revenue limit district. Even though we're basic aid, we have to assume, as they did 7 years ago when they did mid-year cuts, as they did a number of years ago when they suspended Prop 98, basic aid districts have a what they call fair share of the pain clause. We would have to come up with a calculated amount based upon our established revenue limit of how much money this would cost us. Having put forth what the governor proposes and how he would go about addressing the education community in this prospect of helping solve the problem, it is a general consensus of a number of people that there's almost a zero chance that his proposals would be enacted. that it's simply so draconian and so chaotic for school districts that it wouldn't have a chance once it's established what the truth of the situation would be. Yet it is a beginning point which has many disturbing pieces to it. The governor is willing to throw education under the bus. The concept of special ed not getting funding where it's already not getting full funding is very disturbing. To be mandated to perform certain aspects of an education without the proper funding and be told you have to go to local sources for it is disturbing. So we will continue to watch the evolving discussion. I think it's going to be this support behind education and other aspects of the community against the suspension of Prop 98. So I think that's a hill they're going to have to push a rock pretty far up in order to get any kind of a support piece to it. Yeah. Real quick, his proposal centers on no COLAs and cuts to existing revenue limit levels. Change the formula used to determine COLA. And in essence, what he's trying to do is get to a cheaper COLA than the one that's currently in place. Current deferrals of money to be expanded. In other words, there's a cash flow issue for the state that he can save millions of dollars in insurance if he doesn't pay education the money he owes them until September rather than in July. Now think what the effect is going to be if we don't have any revenue limit districts don't have any cash in their bank accounts to pay payroll in July and August or pay their bills or whatever. So there's a problem. It helps. It helps the state. It certainly is going to cause a problem for education. All major categorical programs reduced, period. Special education reduced. The special meal rate is going to be reduced. Child development will be reduced. Before and after school programs reduced. Local property tax backfill reduced. Funding on ongoing programs reduced. It goes on and on and on. He has a couple of new initiatives in there, which I don't know that we need to go into at this point. We'll let them flesh themselves out because the likelihood of his initiatives being enacted are pretty slim. The emergency session of the legislature being called forward, we'll have to wait and see how that fleshes itself out in the next 3 weeks. I don't know how this is going to turn out. I know it's a time for a lot of discussion and good thinking, but we'll just have to see how it works.
Thank you. Questions? Mark?
Russell, I called you earlier in the week and ran a crazy idea by you, and I just appreciated your comments on it. The budget analyst, Elizabeth Hill, had written a report about 2-3 weeks ago where she had pointed out that the tax loopholes in the state of California are somewhere up about $50 billion. And so my question to Russell was, what if we just cut?
Loopholes is a centerpiece of her proposal. What she proposes is the $1.3 billion overallocation to reduce it all the way to zero. So eliminate the over-appropriation. And the way we pay for that is to take the unfunded allocations and unspent and use that as the bulk of it. And then the second part, in order to help solve the $3.3 billion deficit in this year, is to look at the tax loopholes, tax credits that are given. So she has two major pieces of her position paper she's going to start filling out, and they revolve around the $1.3 billion overallocation and the tax loopholes.
Thank you.
Chris?
Well, I was just going to say, it seems to me the governor has changed from being the Terminator to being Freddy Krueger, and what we're looking at here is a Nightmare on Elm Street budget. All of this is disturbing to me, of course. The almost $360 million cut in special education, I think, is going to hurt every student, doubly hurt every school district in California. Not only are we going to see a reduction in special education funding, but we're also going to see a reduction in the COLA and Prop 98 probably, which means that the the monies that come out of the general fund to pay for special education are going to be doubly painful, and this is really a problem. And I hope that the Education Coalition and the citizens of California are able to have some discussions with the governor and point out to him how deadly this would be for schools and for the kids of this state. So that's my hope anyway.
You know, to add to that piece, Chris, and this is where the state starts losing its focus. If they're going to cut the amount of money that's given to school districts for special education, they're going to be found in violation of federal law, which has a maintenance of effort requirement for the state to continue to fund programs at its current level. Districts have that same requirement. We're required to keep our funding at a certain level. It's called a maintenance of effort. Right. But so is the state. If they violate that law, then the funding from the feds will cease to exist. So not only are they putting in jeopardy our programs by not funding it, they're putting in jeopardy their own funding from the feds, which is a huge piece of what we get in special education funding.
Adrian, and then Dr. Valentine.
Mark had a good letter to the editor on this topic. I thought it was well written and, ideas and let school districts take care of things. But I just don't understand the lack of support among those kind of leaders, quote-unquote leaders, because if, you know, you've heard that bumper sticker, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. I think we're seeing how expensive ignorance is, and it's appalling. And in the general public, and all polls do want education to be supported. So if Schwarzenegger wants to cut education, he's out of line with the people. I was talking to actually Mrs. Kucinich, Dennis Kucinich's wife, and she has an idea where, or maybe this is his too, that we're sort of conditioned in this country to think we can't have great education because we can't afford it. We can't have, you know, health care for everyone. We can't have great leadership. We can't have peace because we're conditioned to think those are beyond. We can't afford it. We can't figure it out. For some reason, we just can't have that. And we all sort of have to start accepting the fact, yes, we have to start cutting everything out of our budgets and letting go of things that are really important, like Montana de Oro open for everyone, because we just can't afford that anymore. And I just rebel against that thinking. When we spend, there's so much wealth in this nation. And as a people, we need to, you know, speak out and support leaders who have the kinds of priorities that we support. And we can envision quality education. Prop 98 was supposed to be a contract with the people saying we will have a floor of support that is going to be there. And when you get rid of Prop 98, it's, letting the bottom fall out. So I just rebel against these notions. And in mid-year cuts, we would just go into reserves, right? Russell, we wouldn't actually cut things mid-year for 1 year.
Board decision. It's a lot of money, and it would depend on what your perspective is for your reserves. And remember, this budget that we're talking about in 08-09 is a potential drastic reduction of funding for school districts. And what year is this going to end? So putting our reserves on the table to address a mid-year cut without looking at the other options might be short-sighted. And that's all. That's an option.
Yeah.
And Dr. Valentine, before you go, Mark had one quick comment he wanted to add.
I'm sorry, Dr. Valentine. I think we need to just put one little piece of this in perspective. We talk about education in the state of California being roughly 40% of the budget, and we talk about how large it is. And I think we need to remember that in the state of California, we are ranked near the bottom of what's spent on children and education in this nation. States like New York and Connecticut, New Jersey spend $5,000 more per student than we spend, and we roughly only spend about that much. So I think we need to keep this in perspective.
Thank you. And Dr. Valentine?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I don't think anybody is going to be well prepared for the magnitude of cuts that we're talking about. But I do think that as a school district, San Luis Coastal is in a place where I think some positive things are in place to help us weather what is happening. And again, we're not going to weather it without pain. But I think we have been careful spenders. And when we look at being able to watch our spending in the past and to watch it even closer in the future, I think we're going to have a significant amount of dollars that will fall to the bottom of the budget as an unappropriated balance. We've been able to actually get ahead in our investment for post-employment retirement benefits, the GASB $45, which we've placed in Fund 20. And it's available to us to access in a crisis. And as I said, I think we're ahead of the game in that particular fund. And if we needed to call upon it, we could. The board has instituted a reserve policy that's 2% greater than what is required because our funding is volatile and unpredictable in order to handle exactly that, volatility and unpredictability. We are circumstantially experiencing declining enrollment, which does result in some savings each year. We will see some marginal property tax increase in the coming year, and we'll see how that plays out in the years for the future. And I think we've participated also in some significant revenue enhancement kinds of programs that have produced dollars for the school district that we did not have to spend out of our current general fund dollars. And I think the investment in the special education program is paying dividends in terms of...
On his proposal, right out of the cage, when that 45-day emergency session may occur?
Very shortly, like within next week sometime.
Okay, and during the 45-day session and possibly any continued EST training that the legislature is going to go through from the governor's perspective of not leaving the room, the promised money but not received money that you talked about, that is unlikely to be released during this whole process. Is that correct?
Not known, but I would guess with you that it's unlikely to be released. Okay. We have two types of money that the state gives. Well, actually three types. One is received. That's a good thing. One is where they've given us an apportionment letter, which is in essence a contractor promise to pay. And some of that's been received and some of that hasn't. And then some of it is money that was budgeted but never appropriated or sent. And we have some of that money on the table at the state also. I would mind, but it would be less painful to give up that last type of money where they had promised us the money, but or they had It was money that was given to us in the budget but never allocated. Okay, so we never budgeted that money. So that's not so painful to give up. The painful ones are money that have been promised and appropriated but never sent, should they keep it. That's going to be very difficult because an example would counselors. Okay, they have given us $0 on the counselors, but they have promised us with a contract, an appropriation letter, to give us $250,000, some such number. We've gone ahead and budgeted and spent that money and hired people. And now if they don't give it to us, we will be in serious difficulty with that program. And there are a number of programs just like that that disturb me in terms of them reneging on their contract or promise to pay.
And that's the changing landscape financially that as a district we have to be aware of, and recommendations will be made at the appropriate time that some another step has to be taken to fill that.
Exactly right.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Russell? Thank you very much for that. We're going to move on to item number 3, which is a discussion and comment. Agenda item, proposed revisions to Board Policy 1312.3, the uniform complaint procedure by Mr. Robinette.
Yes. And I was an English teacher about 25 years ago, so I know better. Anyway, this is a proposed board policy revision of a uniform complaint procedures. And basically, we have two recommendations. This came from CSBA to change our procedures. We have uniform complaint procedures in place for any member of the public, any employee, any student, if they perceive that that the district is not being compliant with state or federal laws or regulations, a procedure whereby they can complain and have resolution within a prescribed period of time. And so the revisions we are recommending are basically to follow the new wording under government code of protected groups. So this would be on, if you looked at the uniform complaint procedure, it'd be the third paragraph, which basically now indicates that we don't discriminate on the basis of actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender, ethnic group identification, etc., and also that there is no discrimination on the basis of persons associating with any of those protected classes. So that's one revision. The other is to make sure we include in the board policy the specific areas that are required under the Williams Act. And this would be found in the third paragraph from the bottom that are all in the underlying language. There are now four areas under the Williams Act that the public can specifically issue complaints about. That would have to do with the sufficiency of textbooks or instructional materials, facility conditions that can pose a threat, vacancies or misassignments of teachers, and a fourth one, a new one, which is intensive instruction and services for the California High School Exit Exam for those students who go beyond grade 12 but still haven't passed the CASE, which our adult education program provides. So this is a first reading, and I'm available for any questions, and we'll be bringing this back for a second one.
Thank you. Questions from the board? Adrian? Turn on your mic, though. Thank you.
How do they, procedurally, how do they amend like a court ruling about the high school exit exam interventions? This is kind of interesting to me, because the Williams Act came out of a suit, right? And it was a ruling by a judge. So how does that get amended to add new things to it?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's kind of interesting.
Issues regarding textbooks and, I think, structured facilities, and then that the legislature picked that court decision up and implemented the need to change.
But I don't know how the CASE part was added to it. I don't know the answer to that.
No, my understanding of that was that there was a court decision that was contingent upon a legislation being passed which established post 12th grade assistance in CASE, and then that legislation came forward and was passed, and so it became a part of the decision that was contingent before. Now it was a reality.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Rick on this? I had just a quick question. The protections that are being discussed here, the changes, is the process and the communication of this system well-defined for employees and the public?
Yeah, it's part of our annual notification for all employees. It's part of our annual notification that goes home with all students to families. We have administrative regulations associated with this board policy and forms and procedures. So I think it's well-known.
Okay, user-friendly.
Yeah, as far as filling a complaint out, very user-friendly. In fact, we'll do it for somebody if they want to just verbalize it.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Other questions? Okay, thank you, Rick. And then I think you're here on number four. It's, again, a comment and discussion item, proposed new board policy 4031 regarding reasonable accommodation.
Thank you. No typos that I found, so maybe I learned between item three and four. This is a proposed new board policy for reasonable accommodation. We realized that we have, even though we have policy that talks about discrimination against job applicants or employees on the basis of disability, we have no board policy talking about what we do in terms of reasonable accommodations, even though we have a practice of meeting with either potential employees or employees if we have a disability that needs to be accommodated. And so this is a suggested board policy to add to our array of policies that would just codify what it is we do, which is enter into what we term an interactive dialogue with an employee if there is the possibility of reasonable accommodations that could be made to make sure the essential functions of the job are still done. And so this this would have a series of administrative regulations and timelines that would be associated with it. But the idea is to, you know, have a board policy saying that we will do
fine undue hardship.
That's a tough one because as the law is now written, the employer determines what the hardship is, and yet case law we know is what ultimately kind of determines what reasonable accommodation is. But we would be looking at things like a costs that are prohibitive for an accommodation, or situations where the job, the essential functions of the job, really couldn't be done even with accommodation. So those are the kinds of things that could pose hardship on the district. But as it is now, that's the whole purpose of an interactive dialogue, is to kind of do some give and take and what can we do or can't we do to reasonably accommodate a disability.
Yeah,
it is a hard one. It's largely defined by the courts.
Yeah, and I think that you're right about the financial impact, the ability to perform the essential functions, and then the final they talk about is the safety factor to the employee and to fellow employees in the same area.
In our case, to students.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much, Rick. Next item on the agenda is employee assisted housing overview. This is again a discussion and an opportunity for the board to provide direction to staff, and Brad Parker, who has presented this item in the past, will bring us up to date and continue the conversation. Thank you.
Good evening. You're exactly right. We have discussed this item with the board, and in fact, it goes back for about 2 years now. In that time, we've seen changes on the Board of Education, and we thought it would be appropriate to review the past discussions. And we've seen changes in the real estate market as well, which caused us to think about the process and some of the potential problems that could exist. We start off with a review of the findings, assumptions, and interests that we hope captures the board's vision for an employer-assisted housing program. And if not, we certainly would like to know otherwise, so that, because it could have tremendous changes in how we would try and implement a program. But based upon those findings, assumptions, and interests, we've sort of put together what we think is a possible program that we would be able to implement and assist employees with the purchase of their first home when they come into the district. It's really dependent upon four things. One is creating a fund of money, and we propose to do that by taking underutilized district assets and turning them into a fund. In this case, it's vacant property that we would propose structure their loan as one possible solution and still afford that home and buy the district's interest out. That, in a nutshell, is the concept of the plan. There's a lot more in this agenda item in the way of recapping what we've discussed previously and also presenting a few new ideas and some thoughts. In addition, I would add that we recently met with legal counsel in CESLUC as we're working on trying to flesh out what this contract with an employee might look like and trying to get everything that needs to be there in the contract. And some questions that we will have to address, and believe me, this is not all of them, but the geographic area allowed for participation, that the employee would not own other property, that it would be their first home purchase or, in effect, their first home purchase. If they had purchased a home previously, sold it, brought the money here to put into a, quote, entry-level home, that might be allowed. What qualifications might be placed upon the employee, things like job family, whether they be permanent or probationary employees. There would be some maximum purchase price on the property. Obviously, we're not interested in helping someone get into a $1.2 million home whenever that's hardly an entry-level home. Participation length, you see that I've used 5 years as a thumbnail time frame many times. It could be 7. Could be shorter. Those things would need to be fleshed out too. There are many, many variables in trying to make this complex equation work out. Separation from service with the district and how we would deal with that. Maximum loan to value, maximum loan to income. Would a home include a condominium? Just some of the questions that are going to be coming out, and there are many, many more. And with that, I would be happy to answer any question and listen to the board's discussion.
Thank you very much, Brad, for that. Questions from the board? Mark?
Brad, I just want to thank you for including the van pool. I know we can't get too far on the alternative fuel vehicles, but this is a great start in terms of changing the way we our habits in terms of commuting and getting to work.
Adrian?
Thank you, Brad, for all this work. It's so amazing to me how much work you do preparing these kind of things. I have a few comments about all this. One is, we're talking $3.5 million. I don't think it's worth what we give up for the seven generations ahead for this plan, personally. So I still hold on to that kind of bias against that move. I'm looking at this idea that a contract for a five-year buyout is enough time for an employee to advance step column and COLA to be able to afford to buy out the district's interest in their home. And with the scenario of a $75,000 income and over a $2,000 payment, I'm just imagining this young family where they're spending all their time commuting from Paso or Santa Maria to a teaching job, which is so demanding, and they're spending so much of their monthly income on this mortgage that they really can't quite afford. I see them sinking into debt and stress. I just don't think it's realistic that, for one thing, that they would be able to buy out the district exactly. It's almost like the deferred payment is not repayment. It seems to me more like sort of a balloon payment. That's the subprime mortgage schemes where we think that you'll be able to come up with this after 5 years, but when it gets down to it, it's been too much. And they're not able to. So I don't think that's really realistic. And I'm thinking that in terms of, and I like this, I love the idea of the van pool even for just anyway. I think that's a good idea. I think the survey is a good idea. I mentioned on page 5.5, if we're interested in pursuing it, survey the interest from employees, just about all of it. But I'm kind of wondering if these future teachers that we want to attract. I mean, I look at the young people that I know, and they're buying homes and renting out the basement or sharing. They're kind of more creative in how they finance and less demanding in this whole idea of we have to have this home that we own. I mean, maybe our future employees are going to want to invest in properties where they don't live in these homes, and they invest in real estate somewhere where they can afford it and rent or lease their own housing. So they're taking advantage of real estate markets, but not for their own housing, in order for them to be able to live in places like San Luis Obispo. So I think we might look for employees who are willing to sort of redefine the American dream. So those are my comments on it.
Any other questions for Brad? A couple, Brad. Catherine, did you want to go ahead? Or do you want to wait and I'll ask mine? Thanks. Two things. Where are we in the entitlement process first?
We're just at the end of step three. If you look at the flow chart at the end of, or towards the end of the item, I guess it would be page 5.7. We're at the end of step three, and I'm going to estimate that we would be looking at probably another 24 months until we've completed the process.
I'm sorry, how long?
24 months.
And then the second question, do you believe that there's going to be a discussion in light of this concept regarding priority of employees if there is a demand that requires some kind of determination by the district over?
We'll have to have some direction about whether or not to establish any priorities, and that will come from the board. I included what Cal Poly had done as an example of what one agency had done as a way to try and target certain classifications of employees, new hires, lecturers, tenure track, whatever they might be, and they ended up with 20. Over 20 different classifications and priority levels. And that's a discussion that ultimately the board will have to answer, whether there will be any priority established or whether it will be completely open to employees who qualify financially.
Just financially?
Financially, as well as the things like this is their primary residence. We expect them to live in it, they not own another house someplace, and this isn't an investment. The intent is, at least the way I read the interests, is to assist a family get a house, mm-hmm. not to get them a mansion, to assist them to get a house. And that we've seen that the difference between wages and purchase prices in this area changed to an extent that it's almost become impossible. And we believe that in the future we will lose employees. We may recruit them here, but whenever they get married and they've been trained for 3 or 4 years in our district and they're excellent teachers and they look around to try and find a place to buy, that they're going to move.
Has there been any discussion with Dr. Valentine or anybody else in the administration regarding the timing of the decisions that have to be made internally, even as we go along the entitlement process, so we're not at a point where 24 months...
In fact, we move forward with the project.
Well, at this point, the board had voted to move forward with the entitlement of the property, so we're moving forward, I assume, based on that last vote. So the idea would be that the internal discussion the district must have with the board and the entitlement is going to move along on some schedule to a point where both will have occurred, where action can be taken if that's the final decision of the board?
Exactly right.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Valentine? Go ahead, Catherine, and then Dr. Valentine.
Just a question. I can see how, since this program was first proposed in June 2006, why everyone would be so bullish about the housing market and being in the lending business at that point in time, and so many things have changed since then, obviously, with foreclosures and the subprime market debacle. I'm just wondering if you can tell us how that's affected or dampened your own enthusiasm for this program since then to now.
In the assessment of, I think the numbers changed somewhat, where we started off with a target price, just an arbitrary target price of $450,000. I think that that's lower now, which makes the problem smaller. But it does illustrate the increased risk that we assume by entering a program like this, that whenever there is a significant downturn in the market, we could expect to be faced with some problems. And if we are a co-owner with an employee and the employee defaults on the loan, we would step in, make good on the loan, dispose of the property. Would there be a loss? Maybe. Maybe not. We would obviously try and mitigate that. We mentioned the possibilities. One of the pitfalls early on is that major downturn in the housing market, which I think we are seeing right now. So you can expect it on a periodic basis. It has happened for many, many times.
Well, maybe it's because you're working with CESLOC instead of some of the other lenders that are having meltdowns now because of their choices in underwriting.
They're a solid organization. They're conservative, and I think they're an excellent partner, and I think they're very much in philosophical alignment with what we see as the board's interests in this matter.
Thank you. And Dr. Valentine?
You know, just a couple of thoughts on this. First of all, part of the reason that we're bringing this to you 2 years before we complete step one, which is to create a fund of money, is exactly what you pointed out, Mr. President, and that is that we need, I think, are going to take a long time to resolve, given that we decide to go in that direction at all. I don't think the issue of workforce housing is going to go away for this community. Nor do I think that the difficulty that San Luis Coastal will have in recruiting and retaining employees will go away, and that it is going to take creative kinds of things, lots of creative kinds of things that we should consider in order to address that issue of attracting and keeping talented employees. I'd want to make clear to the public, particularly in these budget times and to the board as well, that we're talking about using capital dollars. This is a funding source. When we sell a property, it creates dollars that are highly restricted and can only be used for similar purposes. We sell property, we can use it, for instance, to buy property or to build facilities or those kinds of things. These are not general fund dollars that would be available to hire teachers or to create academic programs or those kinds of things. So we're really not looking at funneling money away from the district mission of student achievement by using these dollars, and it's important to recognize that separate category. There are a variety of issues that also that need to be addressed. There are labor issues in terms of contract negotiations and what does this kind of program mean in terms of employee obligations and employee contracts and such. So those are all things that we need to look at. I think staff brings this forward largely just to recognize that we would probably be remiss in not bringing this opportunity forward, but I think we need to be very prudent as we consider this and go forward with great deliberation. But I think it's a creative idea that's been well researched, and I really thank Brad for the job that he's done.
Thank you. And then Chris?
Yeah, and I was just going to say, perhaps given the unsure state of the real estate market now, our timing is good, and our timing could be good in the sense that we're at least 24 months down the road from the entitlement. It'll give us some opportunities to really perhaps have the crystal ball become a little more clear, or if, as the prognosticators say, 3 or 4 years the housing market may rebound slowly but surely. So I think our timing is actually quite good on this.
Technology. Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Mr. President. It is, as you said, an item that was expressed by Mr. Peter as a discussion that the board would have about the acceptable use policy of technology. And as the power of technology increases, so does the potential for risk. We have had a presentation in your board books of our board policy. It is also backed up with the administrative regulations, which have been developed to enhance and support the board policy. And we would direct the board attention to specific items of interest in the board policy for comment and review. And we would welcome your thinking on the board policy as it currently exists.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mark?
Sorry. Something that struck me as I read this, I wasn't sure what Dave was looking for, and what I was looking for was student use of technology. And as I read the board policy, it specifically talks about employee use. And then as I got into the ARs, into the administrative regulations, there's discussion about employee use, and then slowly it sort of morphs into a discussion of student use. And what I'm wondering is, as long as we have this before us, is there some way in the actual board policy to include some references to the student use of technology as well?
We can do that, and that's.
I'm used to actually. I think Adrian's right. I'm used to actually seeing two: one that's an employee use, and one that's and we sort of got this combined package.
So the comment would be to separate.
I'm open to administration's response. I found it just a little bit strange to start out, and I was reading this, and it was like, oh, employee, and then suddenly towards the end, it really starts talking about student and parents, and whatever administration recommends later is fine.
Okay.
Well, I had a question about what Mark just raised, and maybe you can help me with this, too. Is everything intended to be teacher-directed towards student, and is that the reason why it's more teacher-directed or administrative-directed, and students are supposedly?
Well, one of the things that has kind of prompted this is the fact that create material on the internet, and I think Mr. Peter's interest, and I don't pretend to speak for Dave, but was sort of to kind of get the board's sense of how much protection is sufficient and how much risk is acceptable when allowing students access to the internet in the classroom.
Thank you.
And keeping with that, just to set the table a little bit for the board, is that we have filtering software that's in place. It's called Lightspeed. Lightspeed is a commercial product that is updated hourly depending on the parameters that we place into it. We can differentiate between staff and student on Lightspeed. In other words, give different blocking parameters to each of those groups. Yet we can't differentiate at this point between a first grader and an 11th grader. So we make judgments on the basis of students as a whole, not as an age group. What might be appropriate for an 11th grader would be totally inappropriate for a 5th grader. And as a consequence, we're always faced with those kinds of judgments. So that sets this item up in terms of our filtering and our software.
Okay. And before Adrian goes, I was just thinking, is this the beginning of a topic or a discussion about the use of technology, the change of technology, how it impacts the classroom, how it impacts the teacher, how it impacts the student? What's good about it and what's not so good about it? I don't know. Go ahead, Dr. Dalton.
Well, very quickly, Adrian.
On take your time.
Well, I think those are valuable discussions. We're sort of at the place now where some of the questions, they are deep and complicated, but the issue is kind of easy to define. And for instance, I mean, even talking about these things, you run the risk of exposing people to things they might not have known existed and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that there are certain broadly used search engines which can produce images that are inappropriate for a school to provide to a student, whether they're a 12th grader or whether they're a first grader. That same search engine is capable of producing fabulous images to encourage student learning and exploration and intellectual exploration. The problem is you can't separate the two. And so we have the...
It's getting at, you know, why is this coming up and what's the purpose of the discussion? So you were kind of saying maybe we need a more clearly defined reason that we're discussing this.
Or no, or what is the scope of this? What's the direction and what's the goal or purpose of the discussion?
Right, I think that would be helpful. But this is generated from David Peter, and I think I remember him being a little concerned that certain sites were blocked because he felt like teachers needed access to these and students also, and that some things were unnecessarily blocked, and he wanted to know more about that. So that's where this came from. Just looking at it the way it is, I had a question. This is a little different about this. But it says these technologies shall not be used to transmit confidential information about students, employees, or district operations without authority. It says computer files and communications, including email.
Correct.
But I wanted to say that the way it's often used, I don't know about this district, but you know, before an IEP meeting where the case manager wants to find out what all the comments are from the teachers, that probably would be considered confidential information, but we gather it by email and present it at the IEP meeting. So I think that is...
Well, the key concept there is without authority. And clearly within the scope of the position and the job of the people involved in that communication, it would be appropriate to communicate information about the IEP, which would be normally confidential. The key piece to remember here is that all emails are discoverable under subpoena. Mm-hmm. And so what you would want to keep confidential in a normal world, you just have to be aware of that. And that's why we have this without authority piece involved.
That makes sense. That was a question on that one. And I think, and bringing up the difference between elementary and high school students. There's a great technology teacher in Lucia Mar, Susie Mino. She went back to the classroom, but she would teach how to use Wizard. There's a website for teachers where you can set up your own web page. Like if you're having students learn about any topic, you research which sites are good for them and pre-choose them and set up your website so that your students just click on the ones that you've already chosen. And I think a lot of elementary school teachers, Mr. Robinette, you've never heard of it, it's absolutely fabulous. The teachers are monitoring and need to be monitoring the students. So I'm more in favor of that type of setting where we do have access, but
personnel are responsible for how it's used, just in general. But don't we have different board policy about student use? This isn't everything on technology. This is about personnel, right?
I think I read somewhere in here that is the expectation, that websites that are referred to by teachers are to be previewed by teachers. I think that's one of the ARs.
Yeah.
Mark? Adriana, did you finish on that? Okay, Mark?
I don't know whether there's another policy on student use, but I think that this one could possibly be modified to include, or it says employees should be aware that computer files and communications are including email. It could say employees and students and their families. So I'm not sure that there's a lot that needs to be done. I just know that it would be probably easier for the community to understand that there are restrictions on web use and computer use and technology use if it were in the board policy as opposed to being buried in the AR.
Any other questions or comments on this? Dr. Valentine, do you have a question?
Yeah, I wanted to address the potential confusion on the item. Mrs. Dickinson, I think, explained very well what we perceived as the original issue of the item was that there was questions of whether our practices and filterings and blockings were overly zealous or not. In the interest of, dare I use the word, academic freedom, the topic came forward from Dave Peter, who was here, but it was seconded by and supported by the rest of the board, and we felt committed to bringing this item forward. If the board is comfortable with essentially the way things are right now, and if the policies look reasonable to us at this point and the issues have not been overwhelming, we're certainly open to continuing and bringing it back at whatever point there are other issues to discuss.
Okay. And Chris, you have another comment?
Yeah, I'm just sort of thinking about what Mark is saying. I would be interested to see if there is a way of separating out a board policy.
I think commonly it's separated between staff and student.
Got it. Thank you.
We can do okay. That.
Any other comments on that topic? Okay, seeing none, then we'll move into the action consent portion of the agenda. And I'll go through 7 through 17. And any board member that would like any of those items pulled, please let me know. Item number 7, approval of the 2008-2009 instructional calendar. Item number 8, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Item number 9, acceptance of donations. Item number 10, disposition of surplus property. Item number 11, approval of purchase orders. Item number 12, approval of furniture and equipment requests. Item number 13, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, the Williams settlement. Item number 14, approval of warrants and payroll. Item number 15, approval of consolidated. I think we might have a pull. A pull for item number 14.
15?
Okay. Item number 15, approval of consolidated application for funding categorical aid programs, is a pull by Mr. Unger. Item number 16, approval of out-of-state field study trip, the San Luis High School Virtual Enterprise Club attending the New York City National Business Plan Competition and Trade Fair. Item number 17, approval of waiver of California High School exit exam, COSSE requirement for students with disabilities. I'll entertain a motion for 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 16, and 17 for approval.
I'll move that.
Mark, Mr. Buckman makes a motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Mr. Unger. Is there any further discussion on those items? Hearing none, all in favor of approving those items? Aye. Opposed? They all pass. Item number 15 was pulled by Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank Dr. Matakovich and Mrs. Delkiskamp and actually Dr. Valentine, too, for responding to a question I had. I was looking over the difference in low-income students as reported by different schools, and I thought it was interesting that Los Osos Middle School was reported to have 35.5% of their students as low-income, yet at Morro Bay High School only 24.8% of their students. And the question, the suspicion is it's not, and I just appreciate your research on that.
Okay.
I don't know if other people have
any
comments or
any not. Further comments on that item.
Yeah, if I could just, I was particularly taken with the wording on page 15.3 on Title V. The increasingly underfunded federal program is designed to support No Child Left Behind. I appreciated that wording. I took the time to add up all of these because there was no total that I could find. And I'm really not a math person, and it took me twice on the calculator to get it, but I came up with about $1.5 million that this represents. So all this hard work to fill out this paper, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you, Mark. Hearing no other comments, Mr. Unger, would you like to make a motion on item number 15?
I'll move approval of item number 15.
Do we have a second? Seconded by Ms. Dickinson. Moved by Mr. Unger, seconded by Ms. Dickinson. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. We'll move on to the advanced agenda area of the tonight. Are there any comments by board members regarding advanced agenda items? I was going to mention just, did we agree to remove the Brown Act as an advanced agenda item? We get that off that list?
I think we did.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think we did.
It's gone.
We did it in a private meeting and out in the parking.
We will note that you're kidding, Greg.
Yes, very much so, since this is a public record. Okay. I don't mean to air our dirty laundry in public, but okay. Any other comments on advanced agenda? Is Chris reaching for your button there?
I want to say one thing.
Adrian?
I've noticed that this board is extremely, extremely careful about the Brown Act, and I think that's excellent. Everyone should know that. We monitor each other closely.
Thank you for removing any probable cause for anybody to question this. Thank you very much. Advance agenda. Okay. Seeing none. Gone once, twice. Reports by board members and administrators who would like to begin. Everybody has just had a quiet last 2 weeks, and, Adrian, of course.
Sabrina Rose Dickinson turns 25 today, my daughter's birthday.
First meeting in February, February 5th. It's the next board meeting.
Dr. Valentine, should I be seeing it here?
It's on the left-hand column under discussion.
PE exemptions for, okay, I've got it now. Thank you. Okay. I just want to be able to provide that.
Sure. No other comments? No, we're on to staff and board reporting. No? Is there any motion move to adjourn?
On behalf of Walton Lahr, I'd like to move for adjournment.
As second? Marilyn?
Okay, and I'll second Walter's move for adjournment.
All in favor, we're out of here. Thank you, everybody, very much. Staff.